'Tis now the very witching time of night, when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 3. Gesualdo is a hill town in the midst of the southern Apennines, and like many of its neighbors, including Frigento, a short 2 miles away but 300 meters higher, offers along with its salubrious air breathtaking panoramas of a land that were once commanded by Carlo Gesualdo and his ancestors. Indeed, for pure magic, there are few vistas that can surpass the nighttime view from the park in Frigento, looking down the mountainside to the subtly illuminated hilltop castle of the Prince of Venosa below. Though severely damaged by an earthquake on the 23rd of November in 1980 that claimed the lives of 2,570 inhabitants in the area, the unrestored castle displays a commanding exterior in the village of Gesualdo to this very day. Situated in Campania, approximately 60 miles east of Naples, Gesualdo is not far distant from the glories of the Amalfi Coast and the ancient site of Pestum, the oldest Greek colony in all Italy. Pestum's majestic ruins were yet unknown in the Renaissance, however, and despite their seeming proximity to his castle, Gesualdo would have been unaware that such a city ever existed. Scholars had been searching for them for centuries, but they were not discovered until 1740 and not accurately described until 1779. Except in the most general terms, a similar innocence of Gesualdo's significance as a composer on the part of the populace of his own village was also true until recent decades. The point is confirmed. History is a story of loss and recovery, and comes down to us in bits and pieces.
That's Glenn Watkins, the Earl V. Moore Professor of Music History Emeritus at the University of Michigan. He's the man who literally wrote the book on Gesualdo some years ago, Gesualdo, the Man and His Music, and he has now returned to a set of themes of bits and pieces that he has gathered, brought together, reassembled, and added new questions and hoped to find, and we hope to share with you some new answers in his new book, The Gesualdo Hex, Music, Myth, and Memory. Glenn Watkins, thank you so much for joining us. We spoke with you a few years ago about your book, Proof Through the Night, about music and the Great War, the First World War, and now you've both gone forward and backward, in a way, in coming back to Gesualdo.
That's true, in a sense. This book, The Gesualdo Hex, deals with the music of a Renaissance prince, but also has to do with, in large part, with not just reception history through the centuries, but more especially his particular resonance and telling effect upon composers beginning in 1950 and continuing to the very present day. This might seem a very odd thing that a Renaissance composer could have such a strong impact on so many disparate composers of different languages, but it's true, and the tale that I try to tell here is based upon this very fact that I've been observing for the last 50 years and thought it might make for an interesting story.
It's not just that it's a Renaissance composer who then becomes influential starting in this remarkable halfway point of the 20th century in 1950. It's a Renaissance composer who was also basically dismissed or ignored or even explained away as some kind of an amateur or a mistake, or I think even sometimes the word was used in the literature, a deformation. Who was Gesualdo? Aside from, or maybe that's part of the problem, the biography where we know there was a murder, there were all kinds of accusations of adultery and child killing and other sorts of things. But who was he and why was his music the way that it was?
Well, why it was the way it was is something that one can never explain when it comes to the mysteries of art, I would submit. By the same token, I would suggest that the whole notion of Gesualdo was some sort of a psychopath is something that did not begin to be written about until the second half of the 18th century and began with Charles Burney and his notorious History of Music, one of the first histories of music in the English language. There he called him all sorts of names. And it's well known by this time that it was another historian, an Englishman, who said that he thought he was brilliant. But nonetheless, the association of Gesualdo and some of the more unsavory portions of his biography stuck and seemed to stick to the music itself, and namely the whole business of, you say, murder and a child murder, not founded, not true, a wife murder, founded and true, witchcraft, absolutely not known until in English until this book. I don't know if we'll be able to get into that, Andrew, but the whole business of the witchcraft is perhaps more unsavory and more electrifying than the story of the murders, which was absolutely understandable at the time. I have to just press the point here for a minute. When you say, well, he murdered his wife, he must have been some sort of a nutcase. Susan McClary used that expression when speaking largely of his music. He must have been some sort of a nutcase. Let's just take the psychological aspect of this man and try to say that if he was a murderer, did that make him some sort of a psychopath? The answer is that the murder of his wife was virtually demanded by the social norms of the time. Any person of his station, let alone a prince and one of the most powerful and wealthy men of southern Italy, was virtually obliged to take care of his wife and her adulterer companion when such a thing became known to him. Therefore, he acted upon a mandate, not upon some sort of impulse.
And we see from those things that there is enough colorful material to distract us, perhaps, or to cause us to read interpretations into or overinterpret the music. But to the extent that those things were kept separate, or for that period of 150 years or so where the story was not paid such attention, why was his music not seen as a part of the mainstream of other Renaissance composers?
It was not seen as a part of the mainstream of the Renaissance composers because he comes at the twilight, at the end of the Renaissance. Namely, the expression mannerism has often been used for this late phase, whether it's in literature or in the arts. Many people know some of the – well, just think of El Greco as perhaps one of those popular figures, the Spanish painter, as you might call it, to say the deformed figures, the elongated figures. Some of this distortion we accept in painters, and yet you say, well, is this distortion? I would say not. He was simply filling out the chromatic space of pitches, we should say, that were already available to him, but not just filling out the space, but doing it in such an artful way that Susan McClary, who's done a wonderful study on trying to give a technical description of the modal basis of Renaissance music, suggests that Gesualdo had to have enormous amounts of technical information in order to write this. In other words, this was not some sort of capricious gentleman who simply was scrambling and writing sharps and flats all over the place trying to make it sound like a scrambled labyrinths of some sort. Mm-hmm. The point has been distorted. The whole technical business of chromaticism and the investigation of the chromatic labyrinth was something that had been begun already by the 1550s in Ferrara with Vicentino. He was largely a theoretician, and therefore the musical examples he left behind were not really terribly performable or terribly interesting. Gesualdo not only personalized it, but turned it into a music that was compelling even for its time and now for ours. His music was not ignored or underappreciated going into the Baroque. We have evidence of composers and theorists right through the 17th century who referred to Gesualdo's unaccompanied madrigals as being harbingers of a new expression, something they called affect, a Baroque affect. And even though he didn't write for solo voice or monodies and things or opera and the new forms of the Baroque, Baroque composers and theorists understood that Gesualdo had explored and evacuated a harmonic space that was absolutely essential for the Baroque composer. And everybody knew these sounds, including Monteverdi, Cavalli, right on through Henry Purcell.
Then what happens? If he has this extension through the Baroque and even an investigation of his investigations, does he fall out of fashion? Is it that his proponents have fallen out of fashion and therefore he goes with them?
Simply has to do with the fact that madrigals, which are his major legacy, requires a standing group capable of performing them. Madrigal groups, madrigal societies began to disappear beginning in the early 17th century. There was a trickle of madrigals that continued to be composed through the first three decades of the 17th century. Monteverdi even wrote his eighth book of madrigals as late as around 1640. But that they were already becoming something else. In other words, the madrigal itself went out of fashion. The ensembles, the unaccompanied singers capable of singing this kind of music, went underground because they were what? They were groups that had been supported by the courts. And the courts now were supporting something else, namely opera, monody, you have it. And so it fell out of fashion.
And then when the fashion changed, the human material to continue the form is gone. And so with that then goes the music, and particularly somebody who was experimenting with that music or using it to show ways of, as you said, carving out new areas of notes to use and harmonies to fill in. So therefore, he goes as well. What brought you initially to Gesualdo?
Well, it's like all good things in life. It happened by chance. My doctoral dissertation happened to have been on mid-16th century settings of the Lamentations of Jeremiah, if you can imagine. And then I had a Fulbright to Oxford immediately as a postdoc after I finished my degree. And I thought I was continuing to look after 16th century settings of the Lamentations of Jeremiah, which are settings for Holy Week, Maundy, Thursday, Good Friday, and Holy Saturday, just prior to Easter. During that year, I transcribed endless pages of dull lamentations by ever so many composers. Then I ran across the information that Carlo Gesualdo had written a set of 27 responses for Holy Week that immediately followed the settings of the Lamentations, belonged to the same service, the service of Tenebrae. And I thought, my goodness, I didn't know about that. Come to find out, neither did anybody else, except as a reference. And the year was 1953, and I was in London at the time and went to University of Microfilms there, and I said, I know where the only copy of it was known at the time was the Oratorio Filippini in Naples, and asked for a microfilm to be made. Well, the year went by, and it never arrived, and I sort of thought, well, forget it. And I came home to my first collegiate job, and one day in the mail I received a microfilm and opened it up, and there were the responses for Holy Week by Carlo Gesualdo from this library.
You must have felt like Stanley when he found Livingston or something.
Well, no? You see, they hadn't been transcribed yet. You see, they were in part books. Mm-hmm. They weren't in score. You couldn't exactly see what they were like. Mm. So I began to transcribe them out.
And what they would have looked like, a page. I mean, obviously, after the microfilm over the years, you've seen some of these and held them in your hands. But what does it mean when you say you had to transcribe them? What did they look like and how were they notated?
Well, the notation was on five-line staff, and rather round notes. They were sort of diamond shape. The notation was not terribly difficult. Occasionally, you'd find a ligature or two, which is a certain kind of Renaissance notation. For the most part, the shapes were easily decipherable. They were in the clefs, mostly the C clefs, although also not readily available. But the point is they were not lined up in score. Mm-hmm. They were in individual part books. All the music, let's say a madrigal book might have 20 madrigals, and so you would have all the 20 madrigal books, the alto part for all 20 madrigal books in one book, and the same 20 madrigals for the tenor in another book. So you didn't see them lined up.
So you had all these threads in a way, and you had to take the threads, put them together, and then it's that way they line up that makes the harmony.
Yes. The important part was lining it up vertically so you could begin to see how the harmonies began to shift.
But also, as you said, and why I think it's important just to give that example, however technical it might sound, is you had to have an understanding of the conventions of the day, and that's a part of the larger job of what you or any good scholar has to do, and that is you have to be able to put yourself back into the time of the people who were writing and performing this music.
Absolutely. And in this particular case, say, the convention of the time, they're not always consistent. This idea of the prolongation of sharps or lack of prolongation of flats in the case of Gesualdo was not a tradition you'll find in any other composer known to me. It's simply something that you could find out by looking at the music. I once showed an example of one of these responses to Nadia Boulanger when she came the very first year that I got my first collegiate post, and showed her one of these examples. She said, "I think this is a wrong note here." And then I showed her the originals and the conventions. And she said, "If this is really true, this is remarkable." And I said, "Well, let me show you how it's true." She could hardly believe it. Mm. And she became very fascinated with this music at that time. But there's another later story we might get around to.
So that was your initial accidental discovery in an archive that there were these pieces, and then getting the pieces, having them copied, and then you're transcribing them, and then you decide you want to know more, you want to go further.
Well, first of all, they had to get published, and they were just starting a complete edition of the madrigals by Wilhelm Weismann of Leipzig, being published by Ugrina Verlag in Hamburg. And I said, "Well, why not all the sacred music, too?" So I got a hold of them, and they said, "Well, you have all the sacred music?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do." So it was a done deal, and suddenly we had the complete edition of Gesualdo. And it all happened between 1957 and 1962, during that five-year period. As we'll finally discover later, it was also a period, 1957 to 1960, that corresponded with what Stravinsky was doing exactly at this time, almost unbeknownst to what I was doing, but connecting in a way that we'll explain later.
We're speaking with Glenn Watkins, Glenn with two N's, and we are discussing his new book published by W.W. Norton, The Gesualdo Hex, Music, Myth, and Memory. And if you don't know how to spell it, you will now. Gesualdo, Gesualdo. You have some brief excerpts that you've brought with you, and perhaps we can get a sense of what some of these developments, or we don't necessarily have to say they move forward, they move in his own direction, but what some of these creations were and what some of the experiments were, or some of the ways that he responded to the customs of the day. Maybe we could hear some of those and talk a bit about them.
Well, I suppose the automatic beginning point is the most famous piece he ever wrote. It's a madrigal from his last book of madrigals, Book 6, called Moro Lasso. If anybody knows only one piece of Gesualdo, it would be that piece. I would go so far as to say, however, that it's almost a shame. It's sort of like Rachmaninoff and his C-sharp minor prelude, you know. He claimed to hate that piece because every child who had any chops at all was playing it by age 11 or 12. And so, but there's moral loss. Of course, it is a magnificent piece, but it has just been played to death. And we'll even find out that many of the composers in the second half of the 20th century who started to write Gesualdo pieces could not resist going, first of all, to moral loss again and again. So I think we'd better hear at least the opening of this piece.
The opening of Moral Lasso of Carlo Gesualdo, as a listener, you almost have to erase half of your book in your mind, even if, of course, most people have not yet read the book, but they all will, because we have been exposed in the last 50 years, in 60 years, in classical music and popular music, to movement of sound, combination of voices and experimentation that when Gesualdo did it and then for hundreds of years afterwards would have been very unusual and sometimes for people even shocking. And I'm going to jump ahead just for a second to give you my gut response. And that is, I'm thinking of perhaps the greatest unauthorized use of a living composer's music in a world-famous international motion picture, the music of Ligeti, George Ligeti, used by Stanley Kubrick in 2001 Space Odyssey. And when time is going backwards and we hear these voices, and of course we learn from your book that Ligeti thought Gesualdo was just about as high as you could get. So if we, though, think of church music or madrigals we might have sung in madrigal choir and then say, wow, did you hear how he went, ew, or, He wasn't doing that to imitate a synthesizer. He was coming up with that from out of his head.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the name of Ligeti because, as you say, he was a fan of not just Gesualdo, but also other Renaissance composers, Ockeghem in particular. And for the normal member of our radio audience, the name Ockeghem might not be so familiar, but he was a highly technical contrapuntal master, incredible. And then put that together with some of Gesualdo's harmonic excavations, Ligeti found a combination that he found absolutely so forceful that he couldn't resist it. He even said at one point, Gesualdo was one of the greatest composers of all time. Now that's a pretty strong statement coming from somebody like Ligeti, you know. And you wonder how could that have been the case? I heard him give a lecture at the University of Michigan one day when he was passing through, just on a Saturday afternoon, talking to a group of composers. And I had heard earlier on that the week before he had talked to, I think, at the New England Conservatory, and had talked about Ockeghem and Gesualdo together. Alex Rossford reported it. I sort of thought, I wonder if he's going to talk about Gesualdo again. So I went. And indeed, it wasn't very long. He was talking about his beloved Schubert. It wasn't just Renaissance. Schubert and then Ockeghem and finally he says Gesualdo. And I sort of, I can't believe this. Has the world gone ape or something? It was incredible. And so he went to the piano and played the opening of Belta Poi Ceta Senti, which we can now hear And when it was all over, I went up to him afterwards, and it so happened I had a Hungarian translation of my book. Can you imagine? It was translated in Hungarian. And I presented it to him and said, can you read this? And I said, no, it's the reason I'm giving it to you. To you. And he said, well, thank you so much. He said, by the way, I didn't quite quote the Belta Poi Ketla Sente quite accurately, did I? I said, no, not quite accurate. I said, but pretty close. So at any rate, it was this Belta Poi Ketla Sente that he was going around and quoting all the time. And here's the way Gesualdo wrote it.
Tell us why you think that grabbed a hold of Serge Ligeti.
Well, I might even throw the question back to you because I'm so familiar to the music. Did it grab you at all?
Of course.
And if so, why? Is it just more of the same? It's not the opening of Moral Law, so it doesn't just keep sagging down and down.
No.
But there are shifts. And there's a lift. And in other words, Gesualdo isn't just always sagging chromatic harmonies.
Right.
There are shifts of light and dark that happen in colorful ways that do not seem, unanchored. To make a very, only slightly technical point, even when in his most chromatic passages, somehow they're the final cadence. He can be using all the 12 notes of the chromatic scale, and yet he can finally find his way through the labyrinth to end on an authentic cadence, a 5-1. And you say, ah, yes, we're home. In other words, he gets there artfully, and at the end you say, ah, yes, I see where you were headed, and it seems natural and good. The Romantic composers did very much the same thing, didn't they? Mm-hmm. They knew how to use the whole and yet to be able to have a tonal anchor to it. Yes, I will use the word tonal, not modal, because if there's anything I would like to say is that the whole notion of Renaissance being modal music and then suddenly with the Baroque music we have tonal music would be a part of the myth I would like to try to help not destroy but to recolor.
And so that is that there might have been different terms or historians initially might have used different terms, but the thought process was along the same lines?
Well,
as to how music comes together
funny,
and resolves?
It's funny how René Leibovitz, in his correspondence with Schoenberg, was even saying, we see how one can write contrapuntally and yet come up with harmonic solutions and how one can write harmonic music and still write it contrapuntally. Mm-hmm. In other words, one perspective does not negate the other.
As so often happens, categories take on lives of their own and they prevent us from seeing what's actually there.
Indeed, it's the case. What finally gives the lie to the whole business is something that appears late in this book. I've forgotten the page, but I give it an entire page to a photograph of very important printing that occurred in the year 1613. Namely, all six books of Gesualdo madrigals were printed in score. You remember our discussion earlier when I said that their madrigal books were generally printed in part books,
right,
separate from one another. An alto could not see what the tenor part was singing or the soprano or the bass, anybody else. They only saw their own line. In 1613, absolutely unusual for the time, we find a score edition of all six books of Gesualdo's madrigals. And what did this show us? Well, his contrapuntal art for sure, but you could now see what was happening harmonically.
Mm-hmm.
This already suggests, I think it even verifies the notion that people realized that one wanted to see vertically what was happening as well as to see the linear aspect of this music. They might have made an edition of a madrigal or two or even one book, but imagine doing all of his six books of madrigals and putting them in score in the very year that he died.
It points as well to clearly somebody understanding something very special about Gesualdo as I read it, and that is that he expects or wants to encourage that the listener have some curiosity and that the listener wants an unexpected experience. He doesn't just want to repeat things. He wants to have not some quote-unquote critic was just writing in the Wall Street Journal that he understands that Finnegan's Wake is very complicated and that if he spent time with it, maybe he would understand it. But why should he? So this idea that thinking or listening is work, and work is bad. Jez Waldo's not saying I'm going to make it hard for you. I'm going to make it beautiful for you, but I want you to listen to what I'm doing here, right?
Absolutely.
And the other thing that comes to my mind, we've just had a wonderful 3 weeks of all people, Beethoven, with Bernhard Haitink and the symphony. And when I spoke with Maestro Haitink before and during the series, this is a man who's been playing Beethoven as a performer and conductor for more than 60 years. And he's done now, just in the last few years, 3 full cycles with 3 different orchestras of all the symphonies. And he said, if I can get one thing across to people, it's that we have to get back to realizing the unpredictability that Beethoven brought back to music. And that unpredictability, that just because we think we've heard these pieces 1,000 times, we really haven't. Because if we think we know what's coming, then it's not being done in the right way. And if it's not too much of a stretch, I see that coming in some ways out of Jez Waldo, who's just sort of shaking things up and saying, listen, and if you think you heard it right, you didn't until you listened some more.
Yes, this whole business of emphasizing the harmonic aspect of Jez Waldo's music and the linear aspect of it as well brings me to one of our most interesting 20th century composers. Was a composer who really started the whole Jez Waldo revival, and his name, of course, was Igor Stravinsky. The pieces I would like to bring to our attention are his first forays into the world of Jez Waldo. He was to write an independent piece called Monumentum pro Jez Waldo, which when it came about in March of 1960. But in August of 1959, just 4 months before, he did something else. Namely, there were, as I was transcribing the motets of Jez Waldo, I came across a book in which 2 of the voice parts were missing. So what do you do with that, you know? 2 of them, I discovered that there were canonic motets. And if you realize the canon, one of the missing voices was realized. And that left only the bass voice in these 2 parts. It was precisely at this time that Stravinsky had become extraordinarily interested in canonic procedures himself, particularly, it already begins with In Memoriam Dylan Thomas, which begins with the dirge canons, but virtually every work after that, his interest in the world of the canon, some people ascribe it to his interest in Webern, others to his interest in Heinrich Isaac, whether it was the 20th century or Renaissance. The idea of the canon was becoming very fascinating for many composers of the day, and including Stravinsky. So the idea that Jez Waldo, supposedly the supreme harmonicist, who, as many people would say, would deny that he was a contrapuntist at all, that he understood the linear aspect of counterpoint, would have been surprised to find that he ever wrote a strict canon motet in which you just write one voice and the missing voice can be discovered by employing the canon at a certain distance. Well, he did this twice. Stravinsky was absolutely floored by this and said, agreed to write the missing parts. He didn't say, I want to. I brought them to his attention. He was in Venice. I sent them to him in the Hotel Bauer Grunwald, and he composed the missing bass line at once. But the idea of the harmony versus the linear brings me to an observation that Stravinsky made that sort of belies what many of the critics said about Stravinsky's approach to the world of Jez Waldo in his Monumentum, which we'll get to later, namely his emphasis upon the harmonic there, and said that he absolutely destroyed the whole contrapuntal origins of Jez Waldo's music by separating the voices through different colors. I'm getting ahead of my story just a little bit here. But in this completion of these 2 canonic motets, he made a discovery, and he said, for having completed the 2 canonic motets, this crucial observation was important, he said, and I quote here, Jez Waldo's music must be approached through the art of his voice leading. His harmonic system was discovered and perfected through the inventions of voice leading, and his harmony is trained by his voice leading exactly as a vine is trained by a trellis. Mm. I learned this much myself when a few months before composing the Monumentum, I fabricated the lost parts to the canonic motets Da Pacem Domine and Assumpta Es Maria. I think it would be good to hear the end of this completion, Jez Waldo Stravinsky, of the motet Da Pacem Domine, Lord, Give Us Peace.
Amen.
Many people might hear that and say, well, that doesn't sound like just Waldo, and where's the Stravinsky? You had to have listened carefully to the bass voice, and you would recognize that it's a bass voice that just Waldo would never have written. But at the same token, you would recognize that it is basically diatonic music. There's nary a sharp nor a flat in any voice by Gesualdo or by Stravinsky. And he uses some of the pandiatonicism of the 1920s for clashing harmonies through a diatonic means. With that, him having demonstrated his knowledge of an emphasis upon the linear aspect of Gesualdo's music, we can now understand what he then wrote. We now come back to Belta Poiché Trascendenti and the Monumentum pro Gesualdo, which was written in March of 1960. The one that we just heard was composed in August of 1959. This is now March of 1960. We hear at the opening the chords change colors, sometimes from chord to chord. The expression Klang Farben Melodie from Schoenberg's Opus 16, number 3, where, like, say, three chords in a row would be colored by different instruments. And Schoenberg was explaining that the movements could be through colors rather than through melodies. It was the progression of the colors that was doing it. So it was obviously a reversion to his knowledge of Viennese applications of harmony for a progressive movement of music. Webern himself had given a coloristic Klangfarben approach to a setting of a contrapuntis from the musical offering of J.S. Bach. But the whole thing went back to Schoenberg's Opus 16, number 3, the changing chord, the third movement there. There can be no doubt about it that Stravinsky's rising fascination in the music of Schoenberg at this time. Robert Kraft was very busy coming out with all the albums after album of the complete works of Schoenberg, that this was coming to settle in his mind too. So here we not have a clash of opposing aesthetics, but a meeting of the two in which he applies this Viennese Klangfarben idea to the opening of Belta Poiché Trascendenti. And this is where one critic, Lorenzo Bianconi, said that he absolutely destroyed the contrapuntal basis of this chromatic music. Be that as it may, as I think we've already demonstrated, Stravinsky's knowledge of and interest in the contrapuntal fabric have made very clear only 4 or 5 months before. But now we can hear what he does in this, as some people thought was a very strange treatment of Gesualdo's music. In this very madrigal, Belta Poiché Trascendenti, we find that Stravinsky uses another historical reference in the close. In other words, the coda to the entire madrigal. He colors it not with changing colors so much as through a brass choir, which is set to a rhythm that was typical of much popular music in the earlier Renaissance, a form known as the frottola. It's a rhythm that goes dum-bum, pa-dum-bum-bum-bum. You hear it again and again, madrigal after madrigal, dum-bum, pa-dum-bum-bum-bum. And here he sets it with brasses, and it comes out sounding like a Gabriele Canzona. When I first heard this in a rehearsal and a recording session, actually 4 months before its premiere in Venice in September of 60, when this section came along, I couldn't believe it. I thought, my gosh, Gesualdo and Gabriele did live at the same time, didn't they? Actually, they met in Venice one time. Gabriele found Gesualdo something of a loquacious bore, and like many people did, he could talk about nothing but music and endlessly. But that having been said, they lived together. They were contemporaries, and it really shows in this next example in Stravinsky's instrumental setting of the close to Belta Poiché Trascendenti.
It just so happens that a new Pentatone label recording by the early to mid-middle music specialist Philip Herweg has just been released of Stravinsky's 1960 Monumentum Pro Gesualdo, recorded with members of the Royal Flemish Philharmonic Orchestra and on other pieces of Stravinsky's exploration of earlier music, the Collegium Vocale Gent of Mr. Herweg, the Flemish conductor. What we'll hear now is the whole piece, which is just about 6 minutes or so, and it was written, you might recall, as a ballet for George Balanchine. It's in three parts, and it's from live performances from 2009 at De Singel in Antwerp. Gesualdo or Stravinsky, an emphasis on unusual harmonies at the expense of contrapuntal invention, Bianconi or Watkins, we'll let you decide.
Thank you.
a new recording, Pentatone Classics, distributed by Naxos, Philip Herweg from Gent in Flemish land, Belgium. Stravinsky's 1960 Monumentum Pro Gesualdo di Venosa. That conjunction, or I guess today the word is mashup, of 16th century and 20th century that is so much a part of the book The Gesualdo Hex, Music, Myth, and Memory, by our guest this week and next, Glenn Watkins. That's Glenn with two N's, G-L-E-N-N. The book is published by W.W. Norton. We'd like to thank Glenn Watkins for coming in from Ann Arbor to do this interview. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. We'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at Rentap, that's Patner spelled backward, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. And while you're in a computer frame of mind, you can listen to, stream, download, experience the Critical Thinking Podcast at WFMT.com/Critical Thinking. Next week, part two of our discussion of the Gesualdo Hex, Gesualdo and Modernity, with musical examples as well, and our guest, Glenn Watkins. I'm Andrew Patner, and we'll see you next week.